breaking news this evening, you join us amidst reports that a group of militant secularists have attempted to carry out a public lecture. Whilst it's perhaps too early to speculate, suggestions are that this is in response to comments made by Baroness Farsi this week, comparing militant secularists to totalitarian regimes and criticising the militant secularisation of the public sphere. Whilst no groups have claimed responsibility yet, the government have already publicly called for the British Humanist Association to lay down their weapons and talk. Stay tuned for updates throughout the night as we'll be following this story closely. Of February 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: is free expression a dish best served cold? What does Nick Cohen make of f***ing censorship? Does taking the Christians out of Christianity just leave inanity, it almost works? And what's the difference between an apology and a pardon? But first, the usual begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then do head over to our website and make a one-off donation, or subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. All donations are greatly appreciated. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. It's been a hectic week for people who identify as secular liberals. We start this week way back last Saturday when around 200 people gathered in front of Parliament to stand up for free expression at a rally organised by One Law for All in response to the recent Jesus and Mo incidents in various London universities, which we've covered on previous weeks. So first up, we've got some clips of some of the people who spoke. Now, I'm not saying that I'm a hero or anything like that, but try to imagine us spending over 2 hours in the freezing cold recording this and perhaps starting to wonder maybe there was a little bit too much freedom of speech going on, given how bloody cold it was. In fact, it was so cold that I'm thinking about organising a counter-rally, a rally against cold weather, but we'll hold it in June. But anyway, the rally of freedom of expression, that's what we're talking about this week. First of all, here's Richard Dawkins.
If I say you have an ugly face or a horrible voice, you have every right to feel hurt, and I hope I would have the good manners not to say it. But I think everyone accepts that I have the legal right to say it. Where religion is concerned, however, it's another story. Religion is a special case, a privileged case. Why? What is so special about religion? You may be hurt if I say something that you consider insults your religion, but that's no reason why I shouldn't say it. Your religion is your religion, it is not mine, and it's not society's. You're not entitled to expect anyone else to respect it. Religious spokesmen, and it always is men, not women, all too often threaten mayhem and murder if anyone breathes a word against religion. They literally threaten to behead people for a crime no more serious than making a drawing or writing a novel. But the real problem is not the religious wingnuts themselves. The real problem is the accommodationist, appeasing respect that we decent, liberal, nice people wrongly give them. Our own leaders, our bishops, our politicians, journalists, our opinion formers fall over themselves to sympathise, feel the hurt and offence against not the victims of the threats, but those doing the threatening. I've just returned from the Jaipur Literary Festival in India. Sir Salman Rushdie, arguably the most distinguished living novelist to come out of India, was due to speak on a neutral subject having nothing to do with the satanic verses. He's spoken at the festival before, but on this occasion, some local Islamic scholar decided to make trouble. I hope you picked up the quotation marks around the word scholar, by the way. A true scholar studies more than one book. Anyway, The row in Jaipur escalated. A baying, hate-filled mob of bearded youths descended on the festival compound, literally threatening murder if Rushdie was allowed so much as a video link to the festival. And I do mean murder under the laws of India, although under Sharia law it might have been called something else. Under pressure from the local government in India, who had an eye to the Muslim vote in the forthcoming elections, the organisers bowed to the mob, and even the video link was cancelled. Here are two possible reasons why one might kowtow to a violent threat such as was visited on the Jaipur Literary Festival. One, I shall give in to your demands to suppress freedom of speech purely because I fear your threats. But don't for one nanosecond confuse fear with respect. I do not respect you. Now, it seems to me that there's nothing reprehensible in such a response. I wouldn't call it cowardly. I would simply call it prudent. But the same cannot be said of the following patronizing and condescending alternative. Two, I shall give in to you because I know that freedom of speech is not part of your culture. Who am I to impose Western colonialist paternalistic ideas like freedom of speech on your very different and equally valuable culture? Of course, your hurt and offence should take precedence over our purely Western preoccupation with freedom of speech. And of course we'll cancel the video link. Nobody, I think, would express this patronising thought in quite such brazenly explicit terms. But that's the subtext of a great deal of the woolly, liberal accommodationism and appeasement that we saw at the time of the original fatwa and of the Bradford burning of the books, as well as the Danish cartoon affair. Our entire society has gone soft on religion. We need to wake up to the threat that militant faith poses to our whole civilization and stop being so damned respectful.
Also speaking at the rally were comedians Nick Doody and Kate Smurthwaite.
It's always a weird thing to do as a stand-up comic, because the most tempting thing to do is to try and say something so appalling that the free speech rally tries to silence me. It's a weird thing. When you disband free speech, it has to be for everyone, pretty much, with the few exceptions that A.C. Grayling mentioned. And it has to be, the test is, it has to also be for people whose views you find abhorrent or idiotic or even dangerous. Okay, so you can't criticise alternative therapies as being nonsense, which most of them are, without simultaneously allowing idiots to say, I believe that vaccines cause autism, or that sticking magnets down your pants guards against alien abduction. And the point is that the right to make the true and important point is so vital that we need to guard that right no matter whether we agree with what's being said, otherwise you just don't believe it. And from my point of view, free speech is the right to make jokes that other people find offensive. And people find jokes offensive a lot, making a kind of logical fallacy of thinking you can't joke about that because it's not funny. That subject isn't funny, therefore you can't joke about it, which is to misunderstand what a joke is. The joke's funny, the thing it's about absolutely does not have to be. A lot of the best jokes are about things that aren't funny at all. You can find a knock-knock joke funny without finding doors hysterical. And even if the joke touches on something that you feel sensitive about, it's not the fault of the joke, it's the fault of your sensitivity. If I say, why did the chicken cross the road? You've no business saying, how could you say that after my mother was pecked to death? Unless my punchline is to peck your mum to death, in which case I'm picking on you.
Hello, my name's Kate Smurthwaite, and those few of you who already know me probably know me from a viral internet video called Atheist Bitch Slap. Since that video came out about a year ago, I've received hundreds and hundreds of threats, the majority of them threatening rape, which seems to me to indicate that if there is one thing more frightening to fundamentalists out there than someone with a well-formed opinion, it is someone with a well-formed opinion and a vagina. Now, I will be honest with you, I stand before you as something of a fundamentalist. I consider myself to be a human rights fundamentalist, I consider that every human being on the face of this precarious little planet is entitled to exactly the same set of rights, and that extends, as far as I am concerned, from Abu Qatada right the way through to Brianna Manning. I want to tell one quick little story. I've been doing some work recently with some female asylum seekers, teaching them English. And there's one woman in my group who's from Iran, and every class, during class, she gets up at the appropriate time and goes out, excuses herself, faces the right direction, puts her little mat down, prays in the right direction. She would never come to class without her headscarf on when there's a male teacher present. She's somebody who, to my mind, appears to be very devout. A few weeks ago, we were talking about adverbs of frequency. It was a fun class. And we were looking for an example of the word never. And I said, I never go to church. And this woman looked at me and said, I thought she might say, aren't you worried about burning in hell or something like this? What she actually said was, aren't your parents angry? And so I said, no, my parents also never go to church. And she thought about this for a few seconds, and then she looked at me quite earnestly and said, so you're free. And I just want to make the point that we're here, and it's brilliant that we're here, and we're the people who have the freedom to come to this rally and make our voices heard. But we are also here on behalf of millions of people in this country and all around the world for whom the freedom to attend a rally like this is not something they've ever experienced. The freedom to even talk about different kinds of religion and about the ideas behind religion, and indeed in many millions of cases the freedom even to show their face in public is something they have been denied forever. And I'm calling on those people in that building over there not just to defend the rights that we have, but to work tirelessly to extend them to every single human being on this beautiful little planet. Thank you very much.
We also managed to get a quick word with some of the speakers at the rally. Here's Rhys Morgan, whose story was part of the catalyst for the rally. Rhys, you're here speaking at the rally today, and you're one of the reasons why the rally is happening. Can you tell us a bit about what's been going on?
Basically, a lot of people have been told by various people in authority, like their universities or their schools, in my case, to take down satirical religious images. For example, the main one was the Jesus and Mo comic. Well, it wasn't even a comic of it, it was just like the book's front cover. And the UCL, Atheist, Secularist and Humanist Society, were told to take this down by their uni. So other people started putting this image up in solidarity and support. And then they've also been told to take it down.
Now, we've been covering the university stuff over previous weeks on the Pod Delusion. So what happened with your school?
Well, basically, I had the image up and I set it to my profile picture for about a week and then took it down. Well, not even take it down, I just changed my profile image. And then, a couple of days after changing my profile image, some people in my school saw it, got pissed off, and decided to report me to my school after raging on my Facebook page and someone else's Facebook page about it. Because I said, well, no, I'm not going to take this down because it's something that I strongly believe in. And this pissed these people in my school off. So one of them reposted it to their Facebook page and said, oh, look at what our journalist friend Rhys Morgan has been saying. And then I sort of started receiving all sorts of death threats and the like.
So death threats from people from school?
Yes, people threatening to burn my house down and stuff.
Bloody hell. And here's journalist Joan Smith, who explained why she was supporting the cause.
I've never had a religion, and I've always been very keen on the idea of universal human rights. So I'm keen on people being able to profess their religion, but I think equally important is the right not to have a religion. And although for many years of my life I wasn't troubled by religion, more and more, because I've done a lot of work on human rights, volunteering, to work on the cases of prisoners abroad and things like that, I've just seen how people's human rights are oppressed. And it worries me very much in this country that, for example, that students at the LSE and at Queen Mary College are finding themselves under attack for publishing cartoons, which are perfectly legal.
You mentioned that in one of your newspaper columns you got some sort of threats about when you mentioned Islam. And what happened there?
It was in 2005, and I wrote a column actually saying very much what I've said today, which is that when I was growing up, religion didn't play a huge part in public life. And, you know, you could actually know people for a long time and not know whether they had a religion at all. And I said that I deplore the way in which religion has become a big issue, and that I'm not very keen on the Bible, and I'm also not very keen on the Quran. And The Independent got hundreds of emails, all identical, attacking me, which is fine. But then it got one threatening to blow up The Independent and burn me to death, which is not fine.
Yeah.
I think that is the limit of free speech.
Has that made you think twice at all about writing about Islam again?
No.
Not at all.
Because it's not just about Islam. To me, it's about the role of religion in society. And I think religion has a role in private life. And people can profess their religion, they can join with other people, and they can do that. What it doesn't have a role in is public policy. Mm. And it doesn't have a role in telling people who are not religious that they have to live their lives along the tenets of a religion that they don't even believe in. And I think that's the problem now. The struggle we're having is the way in which religious people feel that they can have a say on everybody's lives. Mm. Whereas what we're saying as secularists is actually public space has to be secular.
And finally, we spoke to Anne-Marie Waters from One Law for All to see how she thinks the rally went. How do you think it went?
Very well, very well. We've got a lot of high-profile speakers here because it's a high-profile issue. We need this to be a major issue. It is a major issue, and the more people we get out speaking, the better. But I thought it's gone well. I would have liked more people there, but then I always want more people there, so it's never a complaint.
One thing I thought was very interesting was a lot of people were attacking cultural relativism, and I guess this is something that One Law for All feel very strongly about.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, cultural relativism allows us to give one set of rules for one people and one set of rules for another. That to me is racism. It is leaving people from one particular race and one particular group to an abuse that we would never accept for ourselves. Mm. And particularly, we particularly speak out against this when it's about women. We will accept the treatment of black or Asian women, which we would never accept for white women. I think that's disgraceful, and I think every woman should have the same rights. And we've got to start standing up for that. We've got to end relativism, cultural relativism, to give everyone the same rights, bring everyone up to the same level of rights.
You can hear the rally in its entirety on our website at poddelusion.co.uk. The latest on the situation we reported earlier now, police have now surrounded a building in central London thought to be where the public lecture is being held. We currently believe the building to be Conway Hall in Red Lion Square, home of the South Place Ethical Society, which has harboured suspected freethinkers since 1929. Negotiators have been sent in to try and stop the secularists from doing the unthinkable, but negotiations have been difficult. We're getting word that one of the humanists present keeps proposing negotiations take place in the form of a Socratic dialogue. More as we get it. Now, staying with free speech, you'd be forgiven for thinking that Nick Cohen had organised the recent attempts at religious censorship as part of a publicity stunt for his new book, which is called You Can't Read This Book. Really, though, it ought to be called You Should Read This Book. To find out more, we had a chat with Nick all about it. Here's Liz Luckendorf with more.
Nick Cohen's You Can't Read This Book examines some of the failings of liberals in recent years and the effects of cultural relativism. It covers many of the issues we examine on the Pod Delusion, from libel reform, the religious right, the Leveson Inquiry, and our own homegrown cartoon crisis in London universities. Nick Cohen was happy to give us some time to answer our questions, so we went to the Observer office to ask why this book and why now.
Well, that's an odd question. The answer might be a bit tricky. I mean, first of all, because I'm a journalist, so I have to, you know, I deal with every day what can you say, what can't you say. Then there's little things. I mean, the first one you might understand was just seeing how an oligarch, not a Russian oligarch, a Middle Eastern oligarch, just used the English libel law to cut off every comment about him. It wasn't that you couldn't write about him, but you'd have to put £1 million behind the story when you did. And this is a man who is an actual criminal, a convicted criminal. And my lawyers here were saying, just don't write about him. I thought, bloody hell, I'm a free journalist in a free country. What do you mean? The other thing is quite strange, and needs some explanation. It was a reaction to a very scholarly book by Ophelia Benson and Jeremy Stangroom called Does God Hate Women? It was a very highly principled feminist book about the religious persecution of women. And it was slagged off universally in liberal press. I mean, the BBC slagged this off. to my shame, The Observer, my own newspaper, slagged it off. The Guardian slagged it off. The Independent slagged it off. Now, 30 years ago, a book by a feminist against religious persecution would have been attacked by the Daily Mail, by the Catholic Church, by the Southern Baptists, by the Wall Street Journal. Now it's attacked by people who call themselves left-wing. And so I was thinking about the kind of fear and the kind of self-censorship that allows Western liberals to become the antithesis of themselves, become more Tory than the Tories, and to betray women in the poor world who are suffering from religious persecution. That is a bit odder, but all these things are going through my mind about what can you say, what can't you say? Why is it when you say things that are secularist, that are liberal, that are feminist, that are democratic, particularly to do with the Islamic world, the first people to attack you are my employers here, the Timothy Garton Ashes, the Andrew Miles, the Radio 4 people. What on earth has happened to them? They've become parodies of themselves.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you briefly mention universities, and given all the kind of faff that's going on with the universities in London right now,
yeah.
What are your take on those particular situations? Is it a freedom of expression issue?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look, universities ought to be public spaces where people can argue freely. If, you know, academics rely on freedom of speech more than anyone else, suppose if the Cameron administration, the Cameron-Clegg administration in Britain, were to say, not unusually, particularly for governments in sign of war, our troops are at war, any academic who attacks Western policy in, say, Afghanistan, we're going to fire him or her. There'll be outrage. Absolute outrage. There's freedom of speech, there's freedom of tenure. And yet within the universities, particularly in London, there is a huge problem with the London universities. They go along with restrictions of freedom of speech on critics of religious militancy, most notably Islam. Now, they are cutting out the very ground on which they stand. And if a government were to do what they were doing, people would be appalled. But that just goes to heighten one of the main theme of my book, is that the main threat to freedom of speech, certainly in countries like Britain, does not come from the state. It's not a traditional view of censorship. The main threat comes from non-state actors, religious paramilitaries, the fear, and I hate the word political correct, the phrase political correctness. It's not quite political correctness, but the identity politics, the fear of violence brings, from oligarchs using the libel laws. We're sitting in the Observer newsroom. I can attack any politician I want in the most devastating terms I want. My editor doesn't bother my editor. If I start attacking an oligarch with resources to use libel law, no fault of my editor. He wants me to do it, but they get worried. If I start questioning the founding myths of Islam, everyone gets worried. You know? So you need to start thinking about censorship as John Stuart Mill thought about it. John Stuart Mill did not think about censorship as a state. He lived in mid-Victorian England at the height of liberal Victorian self-confidence. The British state in 1849, when he writes on liberty, sorry, 1859, forgive me, barely exists. What he worries about is the weight of conventional opinion, censure, taboo. And we need to start thinking more about that again rather than the state.
So do you think the censorship we see at the moment, that, like you describe, is this a new thing? Are we less free than we were at some time in the past?
I believe in progress, but I don't believe progress goes in a straight line. I mean, progress bends and it cuts back on itself and it swerves. It's like a country lane. 30 years ago, you were far freer to write about religion than you are now. 30 years ago, Salman Rushdie could sit down and write satanic verses, which actually is not an attack on Islam. There's two chapters of attack on Islam. It's actually a book about anything. It's about the experience of Asian migrants in London. It's a London novel. But he uses, as the experience of migration destroys his characters, they go back to the founding myths of Islam. And Rushdie uses a lot of research on what Islam was like in its early days, which has nothing at all to do with the Hadiths or the Quran, all that nonsense, just as Christianity has nothing to do with the Gospels, as historians believe it, and Judaism has nothing to do with the first five books of the Old Testament. Now, Rushdie could do that. He could do that without fearing being murdered. He could do that more without liberals turning on him. mean, it's interesting. Liberals who now will not countenance any Christian of Islam, and still in a funny way defend Rushdie. That's still the one thing they've got, and they still hang on to that, even though they betray everything that Rushdie stood for. So we are free, but it's not progressive, it's not linear. And if you think it is, if you think you're freer merely because you're your parents' son or your parents' daughter and chronology will set you free, you're making a huge mistake. It doesn't work like that. You have to keep fighting for it.
We're talking about freedom of press, and right now there's the Leveson Inquiry. How can we balance, you know, freedom of the press, privacy, and all these kind of things together?
The Leveson Inquiry is not on the face of the free speech issue. There's no jurisdiction in the world, Sweden, America, far freer societies than we are, that says reporters are entitled to hack people's phone. Although, if you could do it in the public interest and make a justification to cure, you would get away with it, which, funnily enough, no one from the news of the world can. They weren't looking at abuses of power or corruption. There is no free speech jurisdiction in the world that says it's okay to bribe police officers. But because of that, one should be worried about Leveson. So in some sense, it's not my concern at all. My concern is libel. My concern is free people doing serious journalism, serious writing, writing novels, writing plays. You know, I'm not concerned with Leveson. It's just, you know, I don't care. I never even read the News of the World. In my life, I've never read it. You know, I mean, it just doesn't interest me. It's not important. On the other hand, there is a reason to be worried. That's it. What is Leveson going to say? He can't say, let's making hacking phones illegal. It's already illegal. He can't say, let's making bribing police officers illegal. It's already illegal. And there's a danger that what's going to come out of this, from when you remember that the Tory government, like the Labour government before, was absolutely up to its neck in corrupt dealings with Murdoch, and wants to divert everything onto lowly journalists, will be a general restriction on press freedom. Now, that might not matter to your listeners who think, well, the press is just News International, Daily Mail, The Guardian, whatever, except that the internet has made everyone potentially a journalist. I mean, it has. I mean, what is a journalist now? When I started out, when I was young, we used to say a journalist is just a system of a typewriter, and we're just using the same rights as you have or you have, but that wasn't true. It was true in theory, but not in practice. You had to be employed by a newspaper or a broadcast or a BBC or Channel 4. Now, anyone can do it. You're doing this pod, you know? You're as much of a journalist as I am. And so there's a danger of, in a government and a police force desperate to cover up what has been a 30-year corruption of rumours, being political, not journalistic, whacking out general laws that affect every system. Freedom of the press is no longer a sectional interest. It affects everybody.
You can find links to buy Nick Cohen's book on the Pod Delusion website, and I highly recommend it. You can also find a longer version of this interview there as well. This has been Liz Luskendorf for the Pod Delusion.
More breaking news now, and the Daily Mail has just broken the news that AC Grayling looks set to be released from his ivory tower and free to walk the streets following a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. One of the country's most notorious secularists, he's known for having literally written a secular alternative to the Bible, and has committed several acts of talking about contentious issues in public. The government is said to have already started talks with the French government about sending him back to the Laboratoire Garnier, where his silver hair is said to have been grown. Stay tuned for further updates. Another big story this week was that a new survey carried out by the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science UK branch has discovered that many of the people who call themselves Christians aren't actually very good at Christianity, at least in the traditional sense of the word. This is important because it means that next time you're mad enough to watch The Big Questions on a Sunday morning, the crackpots they have on can't implicitly claim to have the support of millions of people who identify as Christian on their side. To find out more, I spoke to Paula Kirby, who's Richard Dawkins' representative on Earth. I started by asking her what she thought the main headlines to come out of the poll were.
So, yes, the report was commissioned by us from Ipsos Mori, who, as everyone will know, are a really established, respected name in the whole world of opinion polling. They are absolutely scrupulous with their clients all the way through in terms of the design of the questionnaire, what we can ask, whom we can ask, how everything's phrased. They ensure that all the questions are impartial, they're not leading, they're not misleading in any way. So they're absolutely scrupulous. They also scrutinize every word we say publicly, but they're very careful in terms of guiding us in terms of what it's fair to say based on these results and what it isn't fair to say. And they don't let us say the things that aren't genuinely shown by the data. So I'm just mentioning that because I've been doing lots of interviews about this topic, and one or two interviewers have said things like, oh, well, yes, of course, if it had been commissioned for a religious organisation, the results would have been different. No, they wouldn't. That's what proper professional opinion polling is all about. The results are the results are the results.
I saw you put all the data sets on the website as well.
Absolutely. As it happens, Ipsos Mori are obliged to do that themselves anyway, which is all part of this openness, so that everything can be seen to be open and above board. And of course, we are a foundation for reason and science. We're all for getting the data out there. But no, in turn, you asked me about the headline information to come out of it. Well, I think there are three things that really come out strongly. The first is just the headline figure, which actually for us is a byproduct of this survey. We didn't set out to establish what proportion of the population had ticked the Christian box, but we needed to establish that in order to go on and survey their opinions. So this survey was conducted in the week after the 2011 UK census, and the first screening question that Ipsos Mori asked people was, looking back to the census that took place last week, what answer did you give to the religion question? And then we reproduced all the different answers that were available on the census. And that was complicated in its own right because the census questions were different in different parts of the UK. But we built all that in. And what emerged from that is that 54%, if our research is correct, of the UK population have identified themselves as Christian in the 2011 census. Now, that's down from 72% in 2001. The second is that when we asked those people, and when I say we asked throughout, I mean when Ipsos Mori asked on our behalf, though anonymously, I should also say people didn't know this research was being done for us, because again, that can skew how they react. So when Ipsos Mori asked them why they'd been recorded as Christian, only a third of them said they'd been recorded as Christian because of their religious beliefs. The really good news, I think, came later in the survey, which is that much of it was designed to explore UK Christians, and we took them at their word. We didn't, despite some of the coverage that's been since, we're not trying to tell people that they either are or are not Christians. If they said they were Christians, we accepted that and asked them the questions. And we were exploring with them what they think about a number of issues that have sort of been on the front line in the battles between those who are pushing for greater religious influence and those who are pushing for less of it. And what emerged really clearly is that when we asked them directly how strongly they supported the statement that religion should be a private matter and should not have special influence in public policy, 74% of them said religion should not have special influence on public policy. Now, that is really our number one top headline, and it's where we would love the press attention to be, because that's where it really matters. This aspect of it, that even three quarters of UK Christians support the separation of religion and state and do not support religion having special influence on affairs of state, I think that is really, really important.
One of the things I thought that was most interesting about the results, looking at the numbers, was the responses to political issues such as abortion and gay rights. And it turns out that most people who identify as Christians tend to actually take the liberal position rather than the more traditional position you'd expect the church to take on these things.
That's absolutely right. And it was very encouraging because really consistently, as we went through question after question after question after question, it wasn't always on every single question an outright majority of the Christians who took the liberal view. But on just, I think, on almost all of them, more supported the liberal stance than opposed it.
I guess finally then, I mean, what's the next step? How can secularists and people who campaign in favour of secularist sort of policies, how can we take this data and use it to maximum effect, do you think?
Well, we knew right at the point where we commissioned this research that we weren't going to sit on the results. So we have shared the full background data, and we have 700 pages of it, as I mentioned, and we're sharing the full results with the British Humanist Association and with the National Secular Society, who, of course, have a very good reputation for very solid campaigning on these issues. And I'm hoping that's going to serve them and us very well, because the thing is, I mean, one thing that some people have said is, well, look, you know, didn't we know all this already? I mean, has it really come as a surprise? And what I would say to that is that, look, there's knowing and there's knowing. There's having a shrewd idea, and we all had a pretty shrewd idea that this would be the case, but we didn't have hard evidence. And the fact is that now we have the hard evidence. And now, when the figures on religion are finally released from the 2010 census, and I think that may not be for a good long time yet, actually. So maybe ages before we get it. But when we get that figure, either the pro-religious lobby will have the decency to bear in mind that we've asked those people who ticked the Christian box and to accept that they don't share their religious views or their pro-religious agenda. So either they will just not make those claims, or meanwhile, back on planet Earth, when they make those claims, this result, this survey isn't going anywhere. This data is out there. We've got it. And we will be able to point to this very specifically. And every time they try to say, the nation's behind us, the nation doesn't want a debate on assisted suicide, for instance, or the nation wants to force Christianity down children's throats in schools, we now have not our shrewd idea, not our gut feeling, but hard facts, real evidence, professionally produced, totally impartial, proper evidence to fight that with.
You can find links to the study and that sort of thing on the Pod Delusion website. Okay, so here's the latest on the situation developing at Conway Hall in London. The militant secularists are now holding a vote on whether to send a strongly worded letter to The Guardian criticising the government's actions. Whilst there are no reports of a schism in the secular movement over this vote, our correspondents are speculating that this is a distinct possibility, especially if the building has an elevator. Regional news now, into the town of Biddeford in Devon, where, surprisingly, something interesting has actually happened. As you may have seen exaggerated by the proper media this week, Biddeford Council has been forced to drop prayers as part of their official meeting agendas. This was as a result of the National Secular Society taking it to judicial review and arguing that, under the Local Government Act, it shouldn't be allowed. So is this a victory for a secular society? It looks like this could run and run, as the Local Government Secretary Eric Pickles has come out against it. I know what you're thinking. What can Mr. Pickles, a man whose name sounds like a Jack Russell Terrier, do about it? To find out more about the story, we were blindfolded in the back of a van and driven to the secret headquarters of the militant secularists at the National Secular Society and spoke to their senior campaigns officer, Tessa Kendall. Here's Liz again.
So just to clarify for us, there's been lots of talk of religion being under attack, as it were, but what exactly does the ruling mean?
Well, the ruling says that the saying of prayers as part of the formal meeting of a council is not lawful under Section 111 of the Local Government Act 1972, and there is no statutory power permitting the practice to continue. Now, what this means is that saying prayers before a meeting is lawful, providing councillors are not formally summoned to attend. What this means is they can do what they like before the meeting, but once they get onto the agenda, that's it, they can't do prayers. That's not lawful. So I should point out as well that this ruling applies to all councils in England and Wales, and the majority of them still have prayers as a part of their official meeting. A lot of people are surprised when we tell them this, that, you know, well over half of them have prayers as part of the official business.
Do you think anyone's going to take notice of that?
Well, they're going to have to, because the law is the law. It's not us, you know, prosecuting somebody saying you must not do this. We did a judicial review, which was us saying, can you clarify what the law is on this?
The most interesting thing from the ruling is basically the response, and there's been such a huge amount of media attention on it. Are there certain groups that are kind of stoking the fire, as it were?
Yes, the very well-connected and well-funded Christian Institute back Biddeford, and they've got a hotline to the Daily Mail and the Telegraph. And you've also got, you know, Christian leaders, bishops and archbishops jumping in, people like Anne Widdecombe and Nadine Dorries, who, you know, inevitably will get into print. So they're the ones who've been stoking it up, really, and generally not being entirely factual. I should add as well that Biddeford are now considering whether or not to appeal. They've got a meeting tonight. Their legal costs are being met by the Christian Institute. And you can't help wondering whether the Institute is following their own agenda or the best interests of their clients. They've been behind several cases in the last few years. The B&B owners who wouldn't let a gay couple stay in the same room, for example, which they lost. Because one complaint about this whole business was that taxpayers' money was being wasted, and it isn't. They're funded by the Christian Institute. We're funded by all our members and by donations.
Now, there's been lots of, as I mentioned earlier, lots of kind of media attention on this. What's been the most erroneous interpretations or representations of the ruling so far?
There's been a couple of things. One of them was the insistence that we're trying to stop prayers before meetings. But it's not. It was during meetings as part of the official agenda. And, you know, some councils have said, oh, we're going to carry on praying before meetings, ha, ha, ha. And it's like, well, yes. You know, you're not defying the law. That's exactly the right thing to do. So the other thing is that, you know, of course, we're destroying the very fabric of society. And the Daily Mail front page said Christianity was under attack and prayers at Parliament and forces chaplains could be outlawed. And they're ignoring the fact that the ruling refers only to the Local Government Act. It's very specific. And, I mean, these reactions, really, they're not entirely surprising, but possibly the most disappointing thing was that not a single MP or peer came out to support the judgment.
It's been mentioned on some of the radio programmes that we've listened to, and also on The Times this week, that the next target might be prayers in Parliament. Is this actually true? Is it in the National Secular Society sites?
It's already been in our sites, actually. We tried through the Speaker. But under the Bill of Rights of 1689, the Commons have got the right to decide on their own processes and procedures. So if it does happen, it will have to come from within Parliament. So we would have to work through our elected and unelected representatives.
And I guess, you know, we had the Biddeford Council ruling, and then we had the Richard Dawkins Foundation release the results of their poll. And then we had Baroness Varzi, who's going, or is, has gone to the Vatican. How has that changed the perspective of all this?
It's just added to it, really. The main thing that's happened for us is just so many people have joined us. We had 200 people join us in less than a week. Mostly, Sammy asked them when they join why they join, and they're just so many times they're, I've had enough, I'm fed up, this is outrageous, we can't believe she said this. You know, these are not necessarily just very so-called militant atheists. These are very reasonable people who just can't believe she said it. Just that they're angry that secularism has been made out as some kind of totalitarian threat to the nation. Whereas, if you think about it, it's the secular aspects of our society that allowed her as a Muslim woman to get into politics. And then, of course, there was a Queen's speech at Lambeth Palace this week where she told the Archbishop of Canterbury how inclusive the Church of England is and how important its establishment is to the nation. And I'm not entirely sure what her definition of inclusive might be.
So you just mentioned that you've had an increase in memberships. Mm-hmm. Has there been anything else, good or bad, from this week's shenanigans?
The main thing, I think, is it's started a national debate about the place of religion in public life. And, you know, despite all the sound and fury that's going on in some parts of the media, this is always a good thing because it reaches people who either don't normally think about this or don't have access to the information, and suddenly they're starting to think about religion in society. And hopefully we can build on this and do something good with it.
Excellent. And I guess to make your life more difficult, how can people join the NSS or the National Secular Society?
Well, there's two things we'd like people to do. We'd like you to go to our website, which is www.secularism.org.uk. But also, if you look on the website, in the campaign section, under Council Prayers, you can see the order from Justice Ouseley, and you can contact us if your local council is breaking the law by still saying prayers during the meeting.
All right, we'll put links to that on the Pod Delusion website. Tessa Kendall of the National Secular Society, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Since we recorded this interview, we have since heard that Biddeford Council are appalling. I mean appealing. Appealing, they're appealing. So we'll keep you updated.
We're just getting some more breaking news into the studio now. It seems a government task force has been set up aimed at combating a particularly fundamentalist form of secularism, like they have in failed states like the United States and Sweden. plans are apparently to invite self-appointed secular community leaders on the strength of their claims to represent people and then form policy around what they say, thus consolidating the community leaders' power and influence in the process. Our sources quote an unnamed source as saying that cronyism is better than letting militant secularists roam our streets unchallenged. Now, I thought that nothing could top 2010, and Activia's declaration that that year was the year of tummy-loving care. But it turns out that this year is also an equally important year. Not only is it the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, in which we can celebrate an old woman continuing to be alive, but it's also Alan Turing's centenary, which is far more important. It turns out, though, that despite the government being so keen on cuts, the one thing they haven't cut is Alan Turing's criminal record, as Peter Rowlett explains.
Alan Turing was a researcher in mathematical logic in the early part of the 20th century, and so helped develop the mathematical bedrock of modern computer science. He was one of the top codebreakers at Bletchley Park in World War II, and so played a vital part in the Allied war effort, helping to break German codes.
You know, I'm now actually officially announcing that I am annoyed at Alan Turing.
That's Samuel Hansen, speaking to me from New York for a podcast that we do together. And he's right, by the way. This year is the centenary of Turing's birth, on 23rd of June 1912, and so it is apt that many people are taking the opportunity to celebrate the life of this great man. However, this is sometimes being taken too far. There are many other mathematicians and scientists who have contributed to the advancement of human knowledge, and plenty of others involved with the code-breaking effort at Bletchley Park and the development of computers thereafter. For example, in the end of last year, there was a piece in the Sunday Times that claimed that had Turing lived, Silicon Valley and companies like Apple and Google could be located in the UK. This despite the fact that by the time of his death, the US computer industry was already massive and Turing had turned his brilliant intellect to morphogenesis and the mathematics behind the biochemistry that causes animal patterns. Let's be clear, what Turing did was brilliant, but we should celebrate what Turing actually did, not some imagined feats, and we should not forget others in doing so. After the war, people who worked at Bletchley Park were banned from talking about their work, and Turing went on to an academic career. Turing was gay, which was illegal under a terrible law, Section 11 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act 1885. It's an interesting story, but suffice to say he was convicted of gross indecency with another man and forced to undergo a hormonal treatment designed to suppress his homosexuality. As a result, his security clearance to the British code-breaking unit GCHQ was withdrawn and Turing was labelled a security risk. Turing died of cyanide poisoning on 7th of June 1954, widely believed to be suicide. In September 2009, following an e-petition, then Prime Minister Gordon Brown issued an official apology to Turing. In doing so, he said, "Alan and the many thousands of other gay men who were convicted, as he was convicted, under homophobic laws, were treated terribly. Over the years, millions more lived in fear of conviction. We're sorry," he said, "you deserved so much better." Now there is another e-petition, this one calling for a pardon. As I said to Samuel, it isn't entirely apparent to me quite what the difference is between an apology and an official government apology and a pardon, but anyway.
So, say in 100 years, they're going back through, or not 100 years, say 1,000 years, say when the world is drastically different and history has gotten all muddled up, and so they find something about this Alan Turing guy who apparently created the computers that will eventually be our doom and possibly our savior, and they're trying to figure out more about him, and they see in his official record that he was, convicted of some crime. And maybe the name of the crime doesn't actually mean anything to them by that point in history. The official apology isn't going to be there in the record, but a pardon would actually overturn that and be quite clear that the government did eventually decide, even if it was after his death, that he did nothing wrong.
So John Leach, MP, so he's a Member of Parliament, wrote a blog post in which he reports having submitted an early day motion to Parliament calling for a pardon.
Just a second. That's what MP means? I never actually put that together. I've been very confused by what MP means for a long time, because it means military police over here, Thank you for clearing that up.
Right.
No, MV, Member of Parliament. So the Parliament website defines early day motions as these are tabled by MPs to publicise a particular event or cause and to gather support among MPs for that event or cause. In his blog post, John Leach says that the early day motion is prompted by a petition on the Downing Street website, and this calls for, you know, some way towards healing the damage done by the circumstances of Turing's death, in recognition of the work Turing did, and to act as an apology to the many other gay men who were not well known as Alan Turing, who were subjected to these same laws. So there was a government minister in the Ministry of Justice, Lord McNally, was asked a question in the House of Lords about a pardon for Turing, and he made a statement that a posthumous pardon for Alan Turing was not considered appropriate by the UK government at this time. So this is, I don't know, the statement that he made acknowledges the offence for which Turing was convicted, now seems both cruel and absurd, he said. But he says that Turing would have known the offence was against the law and that he would be prosecuted if he was caught. It says the long-standing policy has been to accept such convictions took place, and rather than trying to alter the historical context and put right what cannot be put right, ensure instead that we never return to those times. There were, of course, many others convicted under the same law. Oscar Wilde is perhaps the best known. Indeed, there is an e-petition now open for a pardon for Wilde, but there are many others who are not famous. People feel a deep sense of outrage over the way Turing was treated, rightly so, but there are men still alive who have criminal records simply because they engaged in homosexual acts while the law was still in place. A pardon for Turing won't lift the crime from their records. Also, a pardon won't undo all the wrong done by that law. Making male homosexual acts illegal opened the door to an unknown amount of blackmailing, which cannot be pardoned away. Anyway, that's the sort of government position. Now, I've seen this reported a lot as, you know, terrible UK government is without honour and won't pardon Alan Turing and blah, blah, blah.
In fact, I've seen the refusal to pardon Turing described as homophobic and an act of malice. Particularly, the complaint is that Turing is still seen as a criminal in the eyes of the law. So,
and in this blog post, Graham Cumming points to a bill called the Protection of Freedoms Bill, which is currently passing through the House of Lords, which, I'm quoting here, specifically allows for the disregarding of convictions under that old law that was used against Turing. Once disregarded, the law causes their convictions to be deleted. And Graham Cumming says it's not quite the same as a pardon, but its effect is to lift the burden of criminal record from those living men, so the ones who are still hurt by this law. If you know House of Lords procedure, it's gone through committee and the report stages on Wednesday this week ahead of a third reading. And if that sounds like nonsense, I'm with you, because I'm not entirely sure what that means either. But it seems to be making its way through towards becoming a law.
Okay, have you got all that? Turing was convicted despite doing nothing wrong under a terrible law, something that is deeply regrettable. The UK government, through its actions in the 1950s, contributed to the unnecessary and tragic death of Alan Turing, and in 2009 the Prime Minister issued an official apology for this. There is legislation currently being debated to overturn the convictions made under that law.
I was going to say, I think the point there that's the most important is that it would probably be better to just do a blanket pardon for everyone who was ever convicted under that ridiculous law. And the deleting of the criminal record, that sounds good too. How about we do them both?
A pardon would be fine. I wouldn't be sad to see it happen, but pardons are rare and complicated, somehow involving the Queen, and haven't been applied in some really high-profile cases where you think they might have. I would say, if you are outraged by this terrible law, push your attention towards the legislation that will delete the previous convictions under Section 11. If you're interested in honouring the life and contribution of Alan Turing, there are many events taking place under the Alan Turing Year banner, which you could take part in, and you could always make a donation to Bletchley Park, who are trying to raise £1.7 million in match funding to unlock £4.6 million promised from the Heritage Lottery Fund for the restoration of the park. I'll put links to the Alan Turing Year website listing events taking place under that banner, the Bletchley Park Action This Day fundraising campaign, and the Pardon e-petition, which is still open for you to sign, and some of the stories talked about in this piece on the Pod Delusion website. This section used with permission audio from episodes 84 and 85 of the Pulse Project Math Maths podcast. This is Peter Rowlett, with contribution from Samuel Hansen, worrying about the difference between an apology and a pardon for the pod delusion.
News just in now, and we've just received a statement from moderate secularist Alain de Botton, who has condemned the attempted lecture by militant secularists in London. He's quoted as saying, "Why do we need intellectual inquiry when we can simply take some religious platitudes out of context and call it philosophy?" More as we get it. Now, which adaptation of Sherlock Holmes is best? Obviously, everyone knows it's the Canadian children's series, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, or maybe the rap parody version that did the rounds a few years ago. But in this next report, Tom Hodden is going to argue it doesn't actually matter, so put that in your pipe and smoke it. Here's Tom Hodden, explaining more.
Hello there, you may have noticed a certain Mr. Holmes has been around a lot lately, in various guises for the last few years. This is largely because, like a lot of other characters of comparative age, he is in the public domain. Here in the UK, all of Arthur Conan Doyle's works are in the public domain, and in America, the last remaining copyright is on the casebook of Sherlock Holmes, due to expire sometime between 4 and 11 years from now. So, for over a decade in the UK, the copyright on the National Treasure has been removed, and we have had free rein to be as creative as we like with him, and do as we wish. But should we have? And if so, whose Sherlock is the true Sherlock? Like a lot of other people, I like Sherlock Holmes. And, like a lot of other people, although I am in no way an expert in the 60-odd canonical stories, when Sherlock was on TV, or in his latest films in the cinema, I got asked, is this the best version of Sherlock Holmes, in my opinion? Well, here is the issue. People assume that, being a bit of a Holmes fan, I will equate best for most accurate, which is not always going to be the case. For example, I love the Robert Downey Jr. films. I think they capture some of the character traits perfectly and weave them into a breathtaking and exciting story, and apart from a few hiccups that would have nagged me regardless of the choice of hero, they are almost flawless adventure stories with a decent mystery at their hearts. The same goes for the excellent BBC Sherlock TV series that has just finished its second run. And, extending the benefit of the doubt, will probably be true for the American TV series currently in development. Both the Sherlock TV series and the recent films have pulled the same trick. They admitted that Holmes is too broad a character to fit on the TV screen, or the cinema screen, without losing something. So they have chosen the traits that the writers consider essential, the purest distillation of the Holmes essence, and concentrated on those. And they have both added new traits to round the character out a little and make him more appeasable for the audience, given the change in media. I'll take the Holmes on film first as an example, because here the tactic is more obvious. They emphasise the way Holmes is apparently aware of even the smallest detail around him constantly, yet fixates himself on a single problem so resolutely that he is also apparently ignorant of the feelings of those he surrounds himself with. They play up the man who is constantly in need of mental stimulation and emphasise this by making him messy and unshaven and oblivious to personal hygiene. And I like it. It hints at the substance abuse of the character by making him into the figure we would associate with the consequences. And let's be honest, Mr. Downey Jr. is an actor who can draw on some personal experiences and give a chillingly realistic performance in this area. It is a fantastic Holmes and will, for many of my generation, be the quintessential Holmes. But he isn't the Holmes from the books, who had the complete opposite problem. Even when his fingers are described as being stained by an experiment, he continues to have high standards of personal presentation. He's the perfectly groomed man who insists a toothbrush is required for even an overnight trip. On the Sherlock TV series, the changes are more subtle, and almost entirely because the character now exists in a world that has moved on by a century and a half since the study in Scarlet was published. The changes to Moriarty, on the other hand, are far more drastic, the foil in the TV show being all but unrecognisable as the good professor, but filling exactly the essential role of being Holmes's equal and opposite. So as a Holmes fan, should I be finding my heckles rise and worry the character has been mutated in the eyes of the public to something new, something that is not my beloved and cherished ideal? Well, no. Holmes has long ago outgrown the constraints of the 4 novels and 56 short stories that Conan Doyle wrote. As I said before, this is a character created for the print medium who's too big to fit onto a screen. We cannot be in the head of Watson watching a film in the same way we can when he's narrating a story to us. They've taken different aspects of the Holmes characters, but neither are wrong or different. More importantly, they are a good illustration of what can happen when a character enters the public domain. If I was to ask to provide the best example of a character entering the public domain and being recreated by other artists, I would offer Holmes as my hero. Likewise, if I was asked for the worst examples, Holmes would probably be my warning as well. But what I consider to be the best and worst examples will differ vastly from the next man's. It's all a matter of taste. Holmes is a character who in various films, books, comics and pretty much any other media you care to name has been taken on by other writers and cast into whole new directions. He has not only investigated the Jack the Ripper murders several times, but has been the Ripper himself. He has pitched his wits against Dracula, Martians, the great god Cthulhu and Dr. Jekyll, just to name a few. He has been brought out of retirement on several occasions and had adventures and misadventures in his youth, likewise on several occasions. In one recent series of novels, he has teamed up with a supporting cast that has included Aleister Crowley, Theodore Roosevelt and Harry Houdini. On the silver screen and the small screen alike, he's been reinvented in World War II, pitting himself against Nazi spies in America, and as a cartoon character in the far future, complete with a robot Watson and a pistol-toting bad girl Lestrade. He has been frozen in time and woken up into contemporary America twice, and has had many, many other adventures. And what is astounding is that no matter how many changes have been made to any one of these incarnations, all of them are recognisably, and without question, Sherlock Holmes. Which brings us to a serious point. In the coming years, copyright laws will have to be reformed. There's no way around it. The evolution of how media is bought, shared and used by members of the public, legally or otherwise, demands that at some point the way this is controlled and the way the laws are enforced will have to change with the times. I truly hope that the public domain is protected with any coming changes. It is essential not just to the creativity but to free access to classic works, and can be used as the foundation for artistic projects the world over, without fear of having to pay hefty fees to access the copyright. I may not be a fan of Pride and Prejudice featuring zombies, but neither am I offended by the book existing. After all, if I were to be snobby about what is or is not the essential Jane Austen, I'd have to give up my just before the books as well. The public domain is an essential and underappreciated resource that must be considered and protected in any upcoming changes to copyright law. This has been Tom Hodden, reporting from Baker Street for the Pod Delusion.
The news has broken in the last few moments that the standoff at Conway Hall in London is now over, with early reports suggesting somewhere in the region of zero casualties. The militant secularists are said to have followed through with their threat to hold a public lecture, but it appears that there was only a small outbreak of learning. Baroness Varzi has released a statement condemning the lecture, adding that she's praying that no one learnt anything at all. And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where if you check out the Pod Delusion extra feed this week, you're in for a bit of a treat, because we've got a metric shit ton of stuff for you to download. We've got the final instalment of the CineSci 6 podcast, which is discussion of the science behind some popular films. And in this last edition, it's a discussion of Memento with Simon France, Mo Costandi and Hugo Spires. If you listen to it backwards, it actually makes more sense. We've also got a recording of Westminster Skeptics from December, in which the convener of Westminster Skeptics, David Alan Green, talks about privacy law and libel reform and all that sort of thing. Also, if you were listening to our show a few weeks ago, you'll remember our interview with Adam Rutherford about the Darwin Day lecture. Well, last week was the Darwin Day lecture itself, and we've got a full recording of the lecture on our website. So if you'd like to catch up and hear the lecture in full, it's all on there. The only thing the audio is missing is the bit where the old woman keeled over and it all got a bit worrying for a few minutes and the paramedics came. And that's not all. We've also got Martin Robbins, friend of the show, speaking at London Skeptics in the Pub about his trip to Africa. And finally, we've got that full recording of Julian Huppert speaking in Reading, which we mentioned a few weeks ago. You can listen to the whole talk he gave in full. All that stuff, plus over 2 years of archives and loads of other stuff, is at poddelusion.co.uk. So if you don't head over there right now, I imagine militant secularists right now are finding out where you live so they can write you a very angry letter. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, if you're into that sort of thing. And finally, of course, if you do enjoy the Pod Delusion and want to support what we do, including all of this extra stuff, then head over to poddelusion.co.uk and make a one-off donation, or subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. All donations are really appreciated and help us cover many podcast expenses. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Peter Rowlett, Tom Hodden, and me, James O'Malley. The sketch in a moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
This is Barbear in Bedford. Now, I know you're a very busy chap, but I was wondering if you've got a minute. No, didn't think so.
Yes?
Hello, is that God?
Yes. Now, what do you want?
Well, blow me down. There's a couple of things, really. I thought you ought to know that we're no longer having prayers at the Bedford Town Council meetings.
Ah, I thought I hadn't heard from them in a while. Put it down to bad reception. You know, sunspots, solar flares. And I've just upgraded to an iPhone 4S. Now Steve's here to advise me.
No, I mean they've stopped saying them.
Is it that bloody Dawkins again?
No, no. Some bright spark said it wasn't right to say prayers in the council chambers of a predominantly secular society.
Are you sure it wasn't Dawkins?
No, no. It was some bloke called Clive Bone.
Right. His name's going in the book.
What book's that then?
Nothing. Never mind.
Now, I know you've got the whole of humanity to watch over, but I just thought you ought to know.
Yes, indeed, Bob, and thanks for the heads up. Now, you said there were a couple of things. What else is on your mind?
Well, I was just wondering if you could help me get the planning permission on my new extension.
Oh, I'd like to help, Bob, but sadly I don't exist. How else is this sketch getting on the Pod Delusion?